I'm glad I looked at that because I held it too long and it paused, and it would have been another one of those times where I got to teach the class again by myself. So, all right, we are pretending that we are in chapter 8 tonight, just beginning it, and of the book of Revelation. Then this is the seventh seal, and the first six trumpets are in these two chapters. And Jesus has opened the first six seals of the scroll. The seals of that new covenant, the book that the Lamb took from the hand of God. And of course, we've seen the war and the pestilence and the famine and the death and the souls of the martyrs underneath the altars who are crying out to God for vengeance. We have seen the decreation of the present system. And now in chapter 7, after all of that, we had this interlude of time. Between the sixth and seventh seal, we saw a great scene of worship there. And of course, all of this is going to be a message of hope to all Christians, but specifically the ones who were the recipients of this this letter in Asia Minor. So now as we open the eighth chapter, we're going to see Jesus open the final seventh seal. And in Deuteronomy chapter 27, and are we sharing that on here? I don't see it on the Zoom.
No, we're having some technical difficulties.
Okay. So in Deuteronomy chapter 27, verses 11 through 13, on the same day Moses commanded the people, "When you have crossed the Jordan, these tribes shall stand up, or stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people: Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin. And these tribes will stand on Mount Ebal to pronounce curses: Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali." And we have in that end of Deuteronomy, we have the blessings of keeping the covenant. We have the curses of not keeping it, of violating the treaty. And chapters 8 through 14 really deal with the violation part of that covenant. And the cursing section, which is Deuteronomy 28, let me flip me up there, or do I have control of that? I don't have control of that, do I? It's not up there. How about that? Well, I see why. The cursing section is Deuteronomy 28, 15 through 68. I don't think I wanted to take the time to read that for you. But it's echoed almost commentary-like, as we will see in these next few classes, in Josephus' Book of Wars. I mean, I'm going to be quoting sections out of his history of what happened during this time, and you're going to say, wow, that looks just exactly like what God said was going to happen. So in Deuteronomy 27, which we just read, that's the second slide, we have those two mountains. And if you look at Revelation chapter 8 and verse 1, and that's not going to be on the slide, it's just going to be in your Bible there, you'll see that it says, "And he opened the seventh seal, and there was silence in heaven for about half an hour." And then we come on down to verse 8, and it says, "The second angel sounded the trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned into blood," etc., etc. So, in the mountain scene here, we have these two mountains in Deuteronomy. We have two mountains here as well. And this is the mountain of cursing that's been thrown into the sea. And if you kind of just skip ahead, and I have that on the slide, in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 1, "There I looked, and there behold me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads." And there's the mountain of blessing. So again, we have these two mountains. We see the two mountains in Revelation as well. So the Deuteronomy section of blessings and curses ends with a promise of restoration. We're going to see that same thing here in the book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. Okay, well, I think we're going to find out that it's pretty much 30 minutes. So And again, it's just it's a picture of something. So let's read verses 1 and 2 again, chapter 8. Then he opened the seventh seal, and there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. So the seventh seal is broken, and I don't really want that picture up there yet. I'll tell you when to let me have it. Yes, I do want it. Thank you. Go ahead. I'm not going to do this, Tim. I'm just going to tell you when to advance it. So we have seven angels with seven trumpets. This is somebody's idea of the seven angels. I look in there, and it looks like there's females in there. There are no female angels in the Bible. But maybe these are males with a little bit longer hair. I don't know. It's interesting, though, in this case, you know, we've been talking about that John will hear something, and then he'll see something. And it's the same thing here, but what we are told is that he saw something. He saw the seven angels. But before he saw something, he tells us what he heard. And what did he hear in verse 1? Nothing. He heard silence. And silence for about half an hour. And what did we hear right before? What happened in chapter 7, right before opened the seventh seal? We had this amazing period of worship and praising God that was going on. Now, you remember when we were, if you were in our Minor Prophets class, in Habakkuk, the second chapter, in verse 2, verse 20, it says, the Lord is in his holy temple, let all of the earth keep silent before him. And that is, of course, after a declaration by God of what's going to happen. And next slide there, 2 Chronicles chapter 28 and 29, the whole assembly bowed in worship. This is when the temple is being dedicated, towards the end of 2 Chronicles, the end of Judah. The whole assembly bowed in worship while the musicians played and the trumpet sounded. All this continued until the sacrifice of the burnt offerings was completed. And when the offerings were finished, the king and everyone present with him knelt down and worshiped. And then if you look at verse 30, it says, King Hezekiah and his officials ordered the Levites to praise the Lord with the words of David and Asaph the seer. So they sang praises with gladness and bowed down in worship. So we have the offerings being offered, and now they're bowing down in worship. Right when that's done, then the king says, now he orders everybody to rejoin this worship again. Now, I'm going to read a quote here from Edersheim's book entitled The Temple. And it's going to speak a little bit about this period of silence that we heard. He says, and he's giving just a description of what happens in the service in the temple. Slowly, the incensing priest and his assistants, so the one who's going to be offering the incense on the altar of God, ascended the steps to the holy place, preceded by the two priests who had formerly dressed the altar and the candlestick, and who now removed the vessels they had left behind. And worshiping withdrew. Next, one of the assistants reverently spread the coals on the golden altar. The other arranged the incense. And then the chief offering or officiating priest was left alone within the holy place to await the signal of the president, or the one who's presiding over this, before burning the incense. It was probably while thus this expectant time that the angel Gabriel appeared to Zacharias. So when you're thinking about Zacharias being told that his wife is going to have a baby and he doubts it, and so he comes silent, but he's in there for a while and he doesn't come out. This is probably the time period and the service when that was happening. And as the president gave the word of command, which marked that the time of incense had come, the whole multitude of the people without withdrew from the inner court, fell down before the Lord, spreading their hands in silent prayer. It is at this most solemn moment when throughout the vast temple buildings, deep silence rested on the worshiping multitude, while within the sanctuary itself, the priest laid the incense on the golden altar. The cloud of odors arose up before the Lord, which serves as the image of heavenly things in this description. And so what we saw there in Revelation is that in the fifth chapter, remember in verse 8, Revelation chapter 5 and verse 8, and when he had taken it, the four creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lord. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And so the prayers of the saints is this incense that's being offered here. It's going up to God. And Edersheim talks about this, and he said, takes about 30 minutes for that whole thing to take place. And the Jews would have recognized that. And they would have recognized this there's 30 minutes or half an hour of silence that we've moved into a period of worship here right after praise. And during this time in the temple, it's silent. Remember when Naaman was approached by Elisha, and Elisha sent his servant, and Naaman was expecting some great thing to happen, you know. And listen, when you're reading from the, we got through the sixth seal, we've had this, and now we have the seventh seal open. What do you expect? When the seventh seal, man, this is going to be great. What is it? Silence. Nothing. So the expectation of the ages is about to unfold and be fulfilled. It's a great picture of awe and reverence. And that's seen in the total silence in heaven. Yes, Megan.
Two kind of symbolic things that I was thinking about like why there was the silence, is that one, like, seven is like completeness, you know, and so to have like completeness in what it talks about, there's the time for this and time for that, there's, you know, time to be and there's time to be silent,
right,
as well. So it kind of is that complete wholeness. And then also, like, in creation, there's the seventh day where God rested.
Okay.
That's, and so it's kind of this rest and this peace, like, after all this work, this worship.
Okay.
That was the time to stop, okay, for a bit.
So Megan's talking about the fact that, you know, in Ecclesiastes, I think it's 3, talks about there's a time to praise and time for silence. So that's the fullness of that kind of a situation. And then in the seventh day of creation, God rested. There wasn't, when the seventh day came, there was silence in essence. There was no work going on. And those are both really good points. So now we have, as we saw on the picture there a moment ago, We have seven angels and with seven trumpets. And there were seven trumpets that were used in the temple worship. Let me have slide 7, Tim. In 1 Chronicles 15, verse 24, if you want to, you can count the names of these priests: Shebaniah, Jehoshaphat, Nethanel, Amase, Zechariah, Benaiah, and Eleazar, the priests, were to blow trumpets before the ark of God. Obed-Edom and Jehiah were also to be doorkeepers. So there's seven priests, and they're blowing seven trumpets. Also, Nehemiah chapter 12 and verse 41, as well as the priests, Eliakim, Maaseiah, Miniamin, Micaiah, Elioenai, Zechariah, and Hananiah with their trumpets. And so again, we have seven trumpets with seven priests there. There's seven trumpets in other places in the Old Testament. In Joshua chapter 6 and verse 4, have seven priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark, and on the seventh day march around the city seven times and have the priests blowing seven trumpets. And listen, they were the ones that were used to topple Jericho. We got seven trumpets now that are going to be used to topple Jerusalem. And kind of a twist in history here. Trumpets were used in religious processions. They were used in ceremonies. They were used in the coronation of kings, calling people to feasts. They were used for alarm. And all of those, too, could have some significance in the fact that we've got trumpets here. Okay, let's move on to verses 3 through 5. Another angel who had a golden censer came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. The smoke of the incense, together with the prayers of the saints, went up before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and hurled it on the earth. And there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. And I don't know if there was an earthquake. There's no indefinite article in the Greek. And so there was earthquake, is how you would actually read that. So we have another angel, as opposed to the ones that each have a trumpet. So this is a different one. And he is standing at the heavenly altar of incense with a censer. And where have we seen this before? Well, we saw it in chapter 6 and verse 9 with the saints underneath that altar. And, of course, the saints were crying out for vengeance. That's in chapter 6 and verse 10. And when he offers this incense, and along with the prayers of the saints here, obviously it ascends up before God. It's welcomed by God. It's accepted by God. And it's going to bring about immediate results. Because now the angel takes a censer and fills it with fire from the altar and threw it to the earth. Which brings noises, thunderings, lightnings, and earthquakes. Now, if you go to the next slide there, in Exodus chapter 19, verses 16 and 18, when Moses has brought the people to Mount Sinai, on the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. If the whole mountain is trembling violently, what are we having? We're having an earthquake. All right, and I don't have this up there, but I would like you to turn there to Psalm 18. Psalm 18. And starting in verse 6. In my distress, I called to the Lord. I cried to my God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry came up before him into his ears. So it's almost like the prayers and the incense going up in this particular case. And the earth trembled and quaked. The foundations of the mountains shook. They trembled because he was angry. Smoke arose from his nostrils. Consuming fire came from his mouth. Burning coals blazed out of it. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. He mounted the cherubim and flew. He soared on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him, the dark rain clouds of the sky. Out of the brightness of the presence of the clouds of advance, with hailstones and bolts of lightning, the Lord thundered from heaven. The voice of the Most High resounded. He shot his arrows and scattered the enemies, great bolts of lightning, and routed them. The valleys of the sea were exposed, and the foundations of the earth laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of breath from your nostrils. And so there is again a description of the same kind of judgment, the same kind of noises, same kind of actions. And there's some irony in the symbolism here as the angel takes his censer and fills it with coals from the altar and throws it to the earth. And listen, almost all the time when you read the word earth in the book of Revelation, you can insert the word land. Because it's talking about the land of Israel. It's talking about Canaan. It's talking about the land that God gave his people. And so let's go over to Leviticus. This is on the slide there as well. Leviticus chapter 9 and verse 24. This is when the tabernacle is just beginning. The tabernacle worship is beginning. And they made this offering. And fire came from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down. Now, let me tell you how significant this is. It's because this fire that came down from heaven and consumed this altar was the fire that they kept burning. It was the only fire that God would accept offerings to be made with. So when you get to the very next chapter of Leviticus in chapter 10, and you have Nadab and Abihu, and what do they bring? A different fire. Their Bic lighter or something. But it wasn't the fire from the altar. And so what happened to them? Fire came down out of heaven and consumed them. So fire from heaven is very important to God. Okay? Now, if we go over to the next one, that when the temple is being dedicated by Solomon. Solomon finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. So this is the fire. This is the fire that God will only accept burnt offerings using. And ironically enough, when a city was destroyed that had been dedicated to God, then that fire was taken from the altar to ignite the fire in burning the city. Let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 13 and verse 16. You are to gather all the plunder of the town into the middle of the public square and completely burn the town and all its plunder as a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God. And if you are offering a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God, you better get that fire from the altar. Because that's what was allowed. I'm not going to take you over there if you want to make a note of it. In Judges chapter 20, when they were burning the cities of Benjamin after their sin, fire was taken from the altar to burn those cities. In fact, what burned the cities of the plain? Fire from heaven in Genesis chapter 19. So now, excuse me, now what are we seeing? We're seeing the angel taking fire. I've got a glass of water here. Excuse me. Taking fire from the altar and throwing it to the earth and burning Jerusalem. It's his judgment against his own people there. And there's a little bit of irony about that. Because the fire from the altar, fire from heaven, was always used in people that God had cursed. I've got four chats. I don't know if there are people that are wanting to... are you on Zoom, Mike? Can you see if any of those chats are people wanting to make a comment or ask a question? Now, let me just step aside from Revelation here for a moment and let me give you a little bit of a historical picture of what's going on in the Jewish-Roman War that is really the cause of the destruction of Jerusalem.
No chat question.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Dan?
Yes.
Before you move on, did he have to send that fire to Jerusalem because there was no fire left that he recognized?
Well, they're not going to, the priests aren't going to be, it's symbolic. Yeah. Yeah, the priests aren't going to use that fire to burn their own city. Yeah, they're so far away from God now anyway. Yeah, though this is symbolism that fire from the altar in heaven, the coals from that fire are being used. Yeah. So, Vespasian, who was a Roman general at the time, was ordered to go to Syria, which Syria is the Roman province that includes Canaan, Jerusalem, Judea, all of that. Ordered them to Syria by Nero, and he hastily gathers an army to defeat the Jews. His son Titus is going to join him at Ptolemais on the very fringe of Galilee, and we'll read about that in a little bit more. And so now he has an army, Titus does, and Vespasian does, of 60,000 men. The Jews are also amassing an army, and they are under the command of a man by the name of Josephus. And yes, it's the same Josephus. It's the same one that wrote the histories. He was a Jewish general. And if you want to put a... if you want to, every time you think of Josephus, if you want to just put the name Benedict behind it, that will help you appreciate who he is. Okay. He also amassed an army of 60,000 men. Now, this is just history. And so they are prepared to defend Galilee against the Romans. So that I just wanted you to have that foundation there. Now, let's look at verses 6 and 7 of Revelation 8. Then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to sound them. The first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down upon the earth. A third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees were burned up, and all of the green grass was burned up. And so the first angel sounds, and we have hail and fire mingled with blood. That should remind you in the Old Testament of the seventh plague on Egypt. It is a triple curse with a third of the vegetation being destroyed. We have the blood here that may be the blood of more slain martyrs. But symbolically showing the reason for the judgment is these following statements by Josephus. This first one is from the Book of Wars, Volume 3, Chapter 4, and Verse 1. By this means he, Josephus, I gave you who the he is in here. That's why my little initials are on the end there, so you can know that it's my comment, not anybody else's. By this means, he provoked the Romans to treat the country according to the law of war, nor did the Romans, out of the anger they bore at this attempt, leave off, either by night or by day, burning the places in the plain and stealing away the cattle that were in the country, and killing whatsoever appeared capable of fighting perpetually, and leading the weaker people as slaves into captivity, so that Galilee was all overfilled with fire and blood. That's what we just read. Okay, now let's go to the next slide. This is Book of Wars, Volume 6, Chapter 1, Verse 1. And truly the very view itself of the country was a melancholy thing, for those places which were before adorned with trees and pleasant gardens were now become a desolate country every way. And its trees were all cut down, nor could any foreigner that had formerly seen Judea and the most beautiful suburbs of the city and now saw it as a desert, but lament and mourn sadly at its so great a change. For the war had laid all the signs of beauty quite waste. Nor if any one that had known the place before had come on a sudden to it now, would he have known it again. But though he were at the city itself, yet he would have inquired for it, notwithstanding. I sometimes, as I'm reading Josephus, I'm thinking, he went to the same school Paul did, because he got sentences this long. So Josephus is describing, and I'm not saying that this is the fulfillment of that, I'm saying that this is the picture that we see in Revelation, and we can see that there's fulfillment in it, even in this. And they would have recognized that as well. Verses 8 and 9. The second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea was turned into blood. And so we have this great mountain burning with fire, thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea becomes blood. And again, that should remind you of a couple of things. Number one, the first plague, where the water was turned into blood. That's the obvious one. But the second is that of the mountain imagery. And that's because God's people are often referred to as a mountain. The next slide there, for Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2, Isaiah spoke of the mountain of the Lord's house being established. The mountain of the Lord's temple or house will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream into it. I don't have it on the screen, but if you go back to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 18. Hebrews 12, 18. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm. And then skipping down to verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to the thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. And so there's the mountain of cursing and the mountain of blessing, the mountain of Zion. Well, it's this mountain of cursing that has been, according to Revelation here, it's been thrown into the sea. Does that remind you of anything? Let's go to the next slide, Matthew chapter 21, verses 20 and 21. When the disciples saw this is about the fig tree that had shriveled up. How did the fig tree wither so quickly, they asked. Jesus replied, truly I tell you, if you have faith and do not doubt, not only can you do what was done to the fig tree, but also you can say to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and it will be done. If you believe, you will receive whatever you ask for in prayer. Now, when we read this, you know, we're thinking Jesus is just making a big exaggeration. You think shriveling a fig tree is a lot. Listen, if you just tell this mountain to go throw itself into the sea, it'll happen. Like Jesus is saying, if you don't want to have to climb that mountain, you know, and they'll just change the topography and we'll just have it thrown into the sea and it will be done. No, he's not being flippant. He's not being exaggerating here. Jesus is telling his disciples here in Matthew 21 to pray imprecatory prayers, to pray prayers of judgment. Listen, remember the saints under the altar? What are they praying for? They're praying for vengeance. And this is a mountain. This is a mountain of cursing. This is a mountain that used to be God's people and is no longer God's people. It's God's enemy now. And Jesus is telling the saints here, and the saints under the altar are praying, throw apostate Israel into the sea. Listen, by the way, that was written before the deed. Jesus wrote, obviously, in Matthew 21, but what we're reading in Revelation is also written prior to that mountain being thrown into the sea. And if you remember, if you go back, and I don't have the slide up there, but I figured you've got your Bibles open to Revelation, you can open up to Revelation chapter 1 again, and verse 3, where there's the blessing mentioned. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and take it to heart. And some of your translations will have those who obey it or listen and do it. Keep it. I think that's the word. Those of you who keep it. Well, one of the things that you can keep is pray and ask God for vengeance on his enemies. It's made me wonder, and so this is just my comment, but I wonder what would happen in our country and in our world if God's people today began to pray imprecatory prayers about the enemies of God. And say, God, just take that evil mountain that is opposing you and opposing us and throw it into the sea. Anyway, it just makes me wonder. I know we don't do it. So I wonder what would happen if we started. I know, and we talked about this last week, you know, as well, you know, that doesn't sound like a very Christian thing to do. Listen, when the Lord says to do it, it all of a sudden becomes a Christian thing to do. Okay, verses 10 and 11 of back to Revelation chapter 8. The third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of the water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. I thought we were going to get further than this, but we'll finish up with this tonight. So here we have the third angel sounding. This is the third trumpet. And we have this great star from heaven falling, and we even are told the name of the star, which is Wormwood. And we're told that it made a third of the waters bitter and that many people died. In prophetic writing, yes? Imprecatory. I-M-P-R-E-C-A-T-O-R-Y. Imprecatory. And if we had a spelling bee person, they would say either stand down or sit. So I'm pretty sure I was right about that. It's a calling on God for vengeance. There's a lot of them in the Psalms. In the Old Testament, especially in prophetic writings, stars stand for political dignitaries. They stand for rulers. And let's go to the next slide, Tim. Isaiah 14:12. How you have fallen from heaven, morning star. And I put in there what you find in the King James Version, the New King James Version. They put the name Lucifer in there. Son of the dawn, you have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. And in the context of Isaiah 14, it's talking about the king of Babylon. And he's being called a star there. The Hebrew word there is Halel, H-E-L-E-L. And it literally means shining one. That's the Hebrew word. And this is free. So why did the King James Version put Lucifer in there? And why did they capitalize it? And why did they make it a person? And that when you hear the word Lucifer, what do you think? Who are you thinking of? You're thinking of Satan. So what happened is that the King James Version, instead of following the Hebrew, followed the Latin Vulgate. And here's the passage from the Latin Vulgate up there. Quomodo sesistidisti de seelo Lucifer, Kimane oriberis, and then the latter part, I'm not going to even try to think about reading that. But the middle part there where it says Seilo Lucifer, Seilo is heavens. How many of you have taken Spanish? You know that the sky is cielo. Okay, so that's heavens. Lucifer sounds a lot like lucent. It has the word light in it, and that's what it means. Actually, Lucifer means morning star or son of the dawn, which is Venus. That's the morning star. That's the son of the dawn. And It's just a word. It's a word that means morning star. It has nothing to do with a person named Lucifer. Okay? And it's not a proper name in the Latin. It's not capitalized in the Latin. It's just a word. And so now, because the King James decided it was a person and followed the Vulgate, now you have capital L Lucifer and a whole Pandora's box of confusion was opened up as a result of that. Yes, Paul.
I think in the Septuagint also the word star is referred to as Lucifer.
I don't know. I'll have to look at that because it's not the Greek. The Septuagint is a Greek work, not a Latin work. So I can't tell you. I'll have to look that up. And if it is, it's in the translation, they've just translated it that way. I'm pretty sure, though, probably the Septuagint refers to a morning star, to Venus or something like that. So this star that fell down, this political dignitary, this ruler of whatever sort he is, that caused bitterness and death, this is the one in Revelation. And wormwood is a word that is used for destruction and judgment. Go over to the next slide there, Tim. Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 13 through 15. The Lord said, it is because they have forsaken my name or my law, which I set before them. They have not obeyed me or followed my law. Instead, they have followed the stubbornness of their hearts. They have followed the Baals as their ancestors taught them. Therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. See, I will make this people eat bitter food and drink poisoned water. And this is where the King James actually gets it right. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel. This is verse 15. Behold, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood. That's the bitter. The bitterness there. And so it's used of destruction. It's used of judgment and judgment from God. So who is this star? Who is this wormwood, this dignitary that fell and caused bitterness? Well, let's look at the Josephus again. Next slide. Now, when the fate of Jotapa was related to Jerusalem, a great many of the first disbelieved it on account of the vastness of the calamity. There's a great Roman victory there. And because they had no eyewitnesses to attest the truth of what was related about it, for not one person was saved to be a messenger of that news, but a fame was spread abroad at random that the city was taken, as such fame usually spreads bad news about. However, the truth was known by degrees from the places near Jotapata, and appeared to be all too true. Yet were there fictitious stories added to what was really done, for it was reported that Josephus, our Josephus, was slain at the taking of the city, which piece of news filled Jerusalem full of sorrow. They were full of bitterness because of it. Next slide. In every house also, and among all of whom any of the slain were allied, there was a lamentation for them, but the mourning for the commander, for Josephus, was a public one. And some mourned for those that had lived with them, others for their kindred, others for their friends, and others for their brethren. But all mourn for Josephus, insomuch that the lamentation did not cease in the city before the 30th day, and a great many hired mourners with their pipes who should begin the melancholy ditties for them. I mean, this is a nationwide mourning because their great commander has been killed. But as the truth came out in time, it appeared how the affairs of Jotapata really stood, yet was it found that the death of Josephus was a fiction. And when they understood that he was alive and was among the Romans, and that the commanders treated him at another rate than they treated captives, they were as vehemently angry at him now as they had showed their goodwill before, when he appeared to have been dead. He was also abused by some as having been a coward, and by others as a deserter. Now, I'm not saying that Josephus is wormwood, but boy, does he fit. This great ruler who has been cast down. Yes.
I was wondering who wrote the wars of who were you quoting here?
This is all Josephus.
Okay.
It's his history. His history of the wars of the Jews. And that's volume 3, chapter 9, verses 5 through 6.
So he's writing about himself?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, he's just telling it like it is. Okay. Who is it said? The winners always are the ones that write histories. And So the Romans won, and he went to that side. All right. So this is one portion of this study right here with Wormwood and the parallel of Josephus here. That again, this great star falls from the sky, and there's all this bitterness and dying, and man, that just fits so well there. All right, so we'll start with verses 12 and 13 for next week.